So today we're going to be talking about 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and also 1 and 2 Chronicles. The original version of 1 and 2 Samuel did not have them divided into two books. They probably were divided into two books because of the convenience of how long, making it a shorter book and how long a scroll could practically be. In the Hebrew numbering of the canon of 22 books, they're counted as one book apiece. And 1 and 2 Samuel, the name in Hebrew is called Samuel, but he obviously didn't write those books. He may have wrote part of it, but he is talked about at the very beginning chapters of 1 Samuel, but he was long gone before even the first book of Samuel was over, much less the second, so he obviously didn't write them. But he is one of the more prominent figures in them, so that's probably why the Jews gave it that name. In the Septuagint, it's just simply called 1 and 2 Kings, and what we call 1 and 2 Kings is called 3 and 4 Kings. In the Orthodox Study Bible, they call them kingdoms, which is a little bit, I mean, the word in Greek is plural, but it'd probably be better if you were really trying to be precise to call it reigns. But since the English language has a long history of calling these kings, I don't see any good reason to change it. So I don't really agree with that decision on the part of the Orthodox Study Bible. But the first book of Samuel begins with the talking about the birth of Samuel. Samuel was basically the last of the judges, but he's not talked about in Judges, but functionally he was a judge. He fit into that time period of Israel's history. One thing also I forgot to mention about the books of 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings is that the Hebrew version that we have has a lot of corruption in the text. There's stuff that's missing. It just wasn't very well preserved, whereas the Septuagint version is usually what scholars tend to think is the better text. They used to think that it was sort of a free-formed, smoothing out of the text until the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, and then they came to the conclusion that because they found the original Hebrew version of parts of those texts and came to discover that the Septuagint was just based on a different version. Another interesting thing about 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings is they're both quoted extensively in 1 and 2 Chronicles, which we'll talk about last. And what's interesting is the version that's quoted is the version that matches the Septuagint and not the Masoretic text. And that's even in the Hebrew. So it's very interesting and telling. But anyway, Samuel's birth was miraculous. His mother Hannah was barren. She prayed and was granted Samuel as a son. She promised God that she would dedicate him to the Lord if he would grant that she would be given a child. You probably know the story. And then you have the Song of Hannah, which is the third ode of the nine biblical odes. And so it's one of the more important liturgical parts of the Old Testament. And then Samuel grows up after he's weaned from his mother. He grows up at Shiloh, and there at this time it's a low ebb in the spirituality of the people of Israel. The sons of the priest, and whose names escape me at the moment, I think you're right, Eli. The sons of Eli were very immoral. They would have immoral relations with women that would come to the temple. They would extort offerings from people that were beyond what the law allowed the priest to keep. And so God pronounced judgment over Eli and his sons, and that was fulfilled when the Philistines went to battle with the Israelites, and the Israelites thought that they could sort of force God's hand and force him to take their side in battle by taking the ark into battle, the Ark of the Covenant. And then what happened was the ark was actually captured by the Philistines, because you can't treat a sacred item like the Ark of the Covenant as if it's some sort of a magic device. and expect that you're going to be able to make God do what you want to do when the people are not living a righteous life. So it's captured by the Philistines. However, if you read the story, you'll see that the Philistines discovered that they bit off more than they could chew. Because while the ark was present, everywhere in every Philistine city that it was present, plagues would come upon the people. They placed the ark in the temple of Dagon, which is sort of a fish god that the Philistines worshipped. And when they came in one morning, the idol of Dagon was knocked over, and then the next morning it was knocked over, and the arms were broken off, and the hands of Dagon were on the threshold of the temple as if he was begging for mercy. And when Eli got the word of this, he was so distraught that he fell over and died. His sons were killed in battle. The wife of one of his sons was giving birth at that point, and she named her child Ichabod, which you might know from the story of the headless horseman, the legend of Sleepy Hollow, Ichabod Crane. But Ichabod in Hebrew means the glory has departed. So it wasn't a very good name to have, even in Hebrew. Well, the people began to demand a king. And if the people had, what you have to understand about the judges is ideally the judges would have all been like Moses. And if the people had been obedient, they would have been continually blessed. People would have been able to defeat their enemies. But because they kept falling into sin, the system of the judges wasn't working. So they asked for a king. Now there actually, there were prophecies about the coming of a king in the law of Moses. There were both good and bad prophecies. Prophecies about the king related to the Messiah. And there were also prophecies about how the monarchy would be a negative thing in many respects for the people, because the kings would amass wealth, put people into forced labor, lay heavy taxes on them, gather many wives into themselves. And you see Solomon as the prime example of a king who did this, which we'll talk about him later. Samuel was reluctant to do it, but God finally told him to go ahead and do it, although if you read the text, it's clear that this was not the best option that the people could have taken, but it was an option that God was willing to allow them to have and for him to even bless and to make it fulfill his plan of salvation. And so Samuel chooses Saul. Saul is initially somewhat successful as a king, but he's wishy-washy. And so the very beginning of the monarchy is talked about starting in chapter 8, and that continues on until chapter 15, where we hear about Saul's disobedience. And then you have sort of the decline of Saul and the rise of David that's talked about for the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. So you have the prophet Samuel twice pronouncing judgment on Saul because of his disobedience, his failure to do what God had asked him to do. And finally, he told him, look, the kingdom's going to be taken away from you. So he goes out and he finds David and he anoints him as king. And you probably know the story. He goes to David's family, asks for all the sons to be brought before him. They bring everyone but David because he's the very youngest and they need him out to watch the flocks. But he's the one that's chosen, which fits a pattern that you find in the Bible where God very often chooses the most unlikely person to be the one that he will choose to fulfill his will, because it's a way of showing that God is the one that did it, not that it was done by just the innate abilities of whoever it is that he chooses. So you have David first coming to Saul's court to play the harp because Saul is being tormented by an evil spirit. And then you have the story of David and Goliath, which is one of the more famous stories in the Bible. But David is the one person, this boy, who has a sling with five stones is the only person in the army of Israel who's brave enough to go out and face this giant that they have. And when we talk about a giant, you have to understand that we're not talking about like that movie Noah, where you have these ridiculous giants that look like the Incredible Hulk CGI version. We're talking about someone who was just an exceptionally large man. Based on the Septuagint, he would have been less than 7 feet, if I remember correctly. So we're not talking about someone who you wouldn't necessarily see someone of similar size even today. There are people who we've encountered in recent history that were even bigger than that. But nevertheless, he was an imposing figure. And we're talking about hand-to-hand combat, where it was all about strength. And if you had a longer reach and you were taller, that certainly gave you certain advantages in battle. So he slays Goliath. Gradually, Saul becomes jealous, but Saul, in one of his more lucid moments, decides just to offer one of his daughters to David because he's trying to keep him in the family. But on the other hand, he even uses that as a means to try to kill David because he says, "For her dowry, give me the foreskins of 100 Philistines." And he's figuring, well, if he has to go out and kill 100 Philistines, there's at least a fair chance that he's going to die in the trying. But he actually got twice that many. And so he married Saul's daughter, Michal. And then gradually he tries to kill David. His jealousy reaches to such a point that David has to leave the court. Although by this time he's become very good friends with Jonathan. So they swear an oath of loyalty to one another. But from this point on, David is on the run. And so he has a band of followers that kind of grows over time. At one point, he actually goes and he lives among the Philistines. And so he learns the way the Philistines fight. The Philistines actually, at one point, brought him into a battle to fight against his own people, which he refused to do. So he went and he attacked some Amalekites or something like that so that he could come back with some loot to make it look like he had fought his own people, but he would not do that. But the fact that he learned how the Philistines fought later was used by God because he was the first Israelite leader to really bring the Philistines to heel. The Philistines were not wiped out as a people, but they were confined to their five cities and they basically were like a vassal state to the kingdom of Judah at this point. So Saul finally comes to a really bad end. After Samuel dies, he's faced with this impending battle against the Philistines. The odds are far against him, and he doesn't know what to do. And so he goes and he consults a medium, contrary to the law, because he's trying to get some word from Samuel as to what to do, which that would probably be the worst way to actually get a word from God, would be to violate God's law in the trying to do it. Well, to the medium's surprise, if you read the way the story is written, the medium wasn't really prepared for what happened. Samuel actually did appear and pronounced another judgment upon Saul and made it very clear that he was going to die, which indeed happened. He and Jonathan both were killed in that battle. And as a matter of fact, Saul was wounded, but knew that he would soon be captured, and rather than faced the humiliation that he would no doubt have been treated to, and then execution at the hands of the Philistines, he asked one of his armor bearers to kill him. He refused to do it, so he actually fell on his own sword and died by his own hand. So it's a very sad end to the first king of Israel. And then 2 Samuel begins with David now becoming the king over Judah. He wasn't the king of the whole United 12 tribes initially, but he ruled over Judah from the city of Hebron. And one of Saul's sons was declared to be the king of the northern tribes, but he was very ineffectual, and gradually more and more people switched their loyalties to David and away from this son. And eventually that son was assassinated by his own men. So David's finally crowned as king in Hebron. The the general who was the general of the son Ishbosheth defects to David, but then out of jealousy, David's general Joab murders him. So after Abner does all these things to help David become king, his own general murders this person, and David pronounces a sort of curse. Joab in his own right was influential enough that David didn't want to punish him for what he did, but he said basically that God was going to get him for it, and that eventually did happen. So then what David does very wisely, there's the city of Jerusalem, and at that point it was still a Canaanite city, but it was right between the border of Judah and Benjamin. It was unclaimed territory, and so he captured it with his men. He had his band of mighty men, which were he had a standing army, and they were very effective. They captured the city, so he made Jerusalem his capital. And you can see there are some similarities to him making Jerusalem a capital with why Washington, D.C. was chosen as the capital of the United States, because in the early days of our country, they wanted to establish a capital, but not in a city that was already existing so that it could be claimed by any of the existing states. It was certainly carved out of the territory of Maryland, but it was right on the border between the northern states and the southern states, and it was a new city, so it had no previous history. And so it was a neutral way of establishing some central authority. And 2 Samuel basically has two parts to it, you could say. There's the part, the first half of it is all about David's rise to power and his increasing success and all the good things that he accomplished and the extension of his rule. But then the turning point happens when it was the time when kings go to war. So his army went out to battle, I believe, against the Ammonites. But David was encouraged not to go into battle because they decided, look, it's too much of a risk to have the king going into battle. We can't afford to lose David. So David stays in Jerusalem. And really, he should have gone with his men, but he didn't. So idle hands are the devil's workshop, as the saying goes. He's in Jerusalem, and he's out standing on his balcony one day, and he sees Bathsheba bathing. To what extent she was in a state of undress, we don't really know. She might have just been washing her face, for all we know. She certainly was not doing anything that was lewd or intending to entice David, but she caught his eye. And so he calls for her. It doesn't really say to what extent she was an enthusiastic and participant in all of this, but in that culture, when the king calls you, she probably would not have felt like it was in her power to say no to the king anyway. So it was an abuse of his authority as well as a sin. And then he gets word that Bathsheba's pregnant. So now he's faced with, okay, I committed this sin, but I don't want her husband to know. And so how do I cover this up? So he calls Uriah back to Jerusalem with the intention that, well, surely he's going to spend time with his wife, and then that will provide the cover for him to assume that this child is his own. But Uriah, the Hittite, who's a foreigner, is more just and righteous than David because he doesn't feel like it's right for his men to be at battle and him to be enjoying the pleasure of his own home and his own wife, so he chooses to rough it. And so David finally gives up and decides that he's going to have Uriah killed. So he tells Joab to put Uriah in the worst of the fighting and then to withdraw his army from him so that Uriah is left out there hanging to dry and he gets killed. So effectively, David adds murder to adultery, and there's, of course, and then he marries Bathsheba, thinking, okay, I've gotten away with it. Well, the prophet Nathan, who is the successor to Samuel, has the famous encounter with David where he tells this story about a man who had only one kid, baby sheep, that he cared for like his own child, And this rich man who had his own flocks but decided he wanted that one man's little sheep, and so has that sheep taken from him and slays it. Well, David's so indignant when he hears a story thinking that it's about someone else that he pronounces judgment over this man. And then Nathan springs the trap and says, "Thou art the man. You're the one that did this." And so judgment is pronounced on David. And from that point on, you see the shift of the narrative from everything good David did to all these bad things that started to happen. Which is not to say that David didn't continue to do good things, but that there was a shift in the narrative. And one of the reasons why I mention this, if you went to a secular university these days and you were taking a class on Scripture, you would probably have the professor, when they talked about David, talking about the pro-David propaganda that's in First and Second Samuel. Because there are all these positive things that are said about David, plus a lot of these critical scholars will try to twist things that are in the story and say, like for example, when it talks about David not being with the Philistines but not attacking his own people, well, this is just propaganda. Clearly he was with the Philistines. He was a traitor, but he somehow went from being a Philistine traitor to his own people to being hailed as a leader, you know. But it's the same kind of deconstructionist approach that you find among a lot of historians these days, where they're always trying to say, well, what you always thought you knew about these famous people is all wrong. But the other thing about that is, if this was just all pro-David propaganda, you'd have to wonder why all of a sudden do they switch to where now it's all negative stuff? But they've got an answer to that. Well, this is now the pro-Solomon propaganda that's trying to explain the reasons why Solomon should have succeeded David. Well, the thing is Solomon was David's son. It wasn't like he usurped the throne. So there's no reason why any of these things would have needed to be told this way. So just be aware that that's the kind of nonsense that they say. But it's also, there's no reason logically why any of that would need to be true. It's clearly the same person that put this book together had all the positive stuff about David and then adds all the negative stuff that follows. So after David sins with Bathsheba, you begin to see the unfolding of the judgment that the prophet Nathan pronounced. And he said that the sword would never depart from the house of David was one of the things that he said, that there would always be strife. And you have the story of David's son Ammon, and who fell in love with a half-sister, Absalom's sister, who was a half-brother. And just as an aside, you know, a lot of people like to point out how the Bible has people who have engaged in polygamy. There's not a single example of polygamy in the Bible where you don't have all these negative examples of why polygamy is a bad thing. Because here you have David with all these multiple wives, multiple families, and you start to see the strife that arises because of that, because he's got all these princesses and princesses all over the place that are vying for position. And so anyway, Ammon falls in love with Tamar, and he tricks her. He makes arrangements to where he pretends to be sick, asks David to send Tamar to feed him and to care for him. David agrees, and then he uses the occasion to rape his sister, half-sister. And so after he does this, it says that the love that he once felt for her was turned to hate, and he despised her and kicked her out. And she was saying, look, you've already committed a horrible thing by doing this. It's even worse for you to send me away, because she said, look, if you ask David for permission, he'll grant you my hand in marriage, and you can at least make good of what you've done. Which, this course, was contrary to the law of Moses for a half-sister and a half-brother to be married, but presumably David could have granted what we would call now economia to the situation. But he sends her out in shame, and Absalom finds out about it. He's just seething with rage, and what makes it worse is the fact that when David finds out about it, he's angry, but he doesn't do anything. And you find that this happens over and over again with David's children. He doesn't deal with these problems. He allows them to fester. And then eventually they blow up in his face. So after this, Absalom begins to plot his revenge. He tricks Ammon along with other siblings to come to a big meal. And at that meal, he slays Ammon. And all of his siblings run out of that place scared to death. And David gets the news that Absalom's killed all of his children, which wasn't true. But David has this horrifying, you know, bit of information told to him. And then we find that what actually happened, he's angry at Absalom and he banishes him. So Absalom goes for some period of time to live with the people of his mother, which were not, they were foreigners. And then Joab eventually tricks David into bringing Absalom back. And David, there was some justice to Joab's rationale, but David still doesn't invite him to come and see him for quite some time. But then eventually he does see him. I can't remember. I think Absalom like set somebody's, I think he sets Joab's land on fire or something like that to get his attention. And so finally David does see him, but Absalom uses the opportunity being back in Jerusalem to start to plant the seeds of a rebellion. He's apparently an attractive guy, charismatic. He stands outside of the palace. When people would come to the palace with some problem, he would say, "Well, too bad that there's not someone like me that has the authority to do anything about your case, because I would certainly find in your favor, but there's no such thing. You're kind of out of luck." And so gradually, without David being aware of it, Absalom begins to build the support base for rebellion. And then when David finally realizes what's going on, after he finds out Absalom's been declared to be king, his advisors advise him to leave Jerusalem, because if he stays there, he's going to be slain. So you have this sad scene where this elderly king who's done so much for his people is trudging on foot out of Jerusalem to escape from his own son. But fortunately, he had one loyal advisor who stayed behind that made an effort to try to trick Absalom into doing stupid things. One of David's advisors who actually did betray him was trying to tell Absalom, "Look, don't attack him right away, because right now he'll be like a mother who's just been robbed of his cubs. And if your army faces a defeat, people will begin to lose confidence and begin to fear David, and you'll basically set the stage for David to return. So just take your time, don't do anything hasty, and you'll be established." But this other advisor said, "Look, now's the time to strike, he's on the run." And so that's what Absalom decides to do. And keep in mind that David had this band of men called the Mighty Men, which were incredible warriors that were more than capable of handling whatever rabble Absalom was able to throw together, even though he had vast superior numbers. He didn't have the skilled men that David had, and in hand-to-hand combat that made all the difference. So David had told his people, "Don't kill Absalom, whatever you do. I want him brought back," because he still cares about his son, even though his son has betrayed him. And also, one thing I should point out is that Absalom was advised, when David left, he took most of his wives with him, but he left several of his concubines behind because he wanted them to be able to take care of the palace. And Absalom used that to sleep with those concubines, and he did it in a tent that was on the rooftop of the palace so that everyone would be aware of it as a way of saying, "I am the new king." And obviously it would be very hard for him to be reconciled to his father after such a thing. But it was a punishment to David. "Look, you steal someone else's wife, and now look what you get. Your wives are being stolen, and what you did in secret against Uriah will be done in public against you." And so when this battle happened, Absalom is defeated, and he's riding on a horse. His hair gets caught, because we're told in the story that he had this very long flowing hair. His hair gets caught in a tree, and so he's left hanging in a tree by his hair. And rather than taking him alive, as he was told, Joab kills him, because Joab is ruthless, And he's politically savvy enough to know that if you have a guy like this and you leave him alive, or you're just asking for trouble, there won't be peace in the land. So he kills him. And when David finds out about it, the joy of his men that they had just won a battle was turned to mourning, because he's just beside himself with grief that his son's been slain. And so Joab takes him aside and he says, look, you won't have a single man with you by tomorrow if you don't go out there and say something encouraging to your men and thank them because they've just saved your life, and you've made them all feel like they've done something shameful. And so he did. So David was a smart enough man to take good advice when he got it. So anyway, David's finally restored to Jerusalem. In his latter years, you see other signs of his decline. The final bad thing that David did was towards the end of his life, he wanted to number the people. So he took a census, and this was considered to be a sin because it's not really spelled out in the text why it's a sin. But for one thing, he probably did it because it was a way of taxing the people, but also a way of sort of puffing out his chest and saying, look at how many people I've got, rather than just trusting that God would be with him and would bless him, and that he didn't need to worry about how many people he had. And so there was a plague that resulted from David committing the sin, and then David repents. And the book doesn't end with the death of David. That actually is talked about in 1 Kings. But clearly, that book closes with the knowledge that David was going to die. Now, whether 1 and 2 Kings was written by the same person or not is not something that we can really know. The earliest that 1 and 2 Samuel could have been written was probably sometime during Solomon's reign or maybe shortly thereafter, just from the kinds of things that it says. But it also probably could not have been written after the destruction of the northern kingdom, because there's not any references to it. And there's things that are said in there where you would expect some kind of allusion to it if that were the case. So 1 and 2 Kings, or 3 and 4 Kings in the Septuagint, are kind of a continuation. Like I said, possibly written by someone else, but certainly written with the same style. And what you find throughout the 1 and 2 Kings is that all the subsequent kings are compared positively or negatively to David. Now, it begins with the reign of Solomon and David's final arrangements. David, in his old age, he was very feeble, and so he had this young virgin that became another one of his wives, to add to all the other wives that he had, that would sleep with him basically just to keep him warm. And her name was Abishag. Well, David had already said that he wanted Solomon to be his successor, but David had another son, Adonijah, who wanted to be the king, and at one point was actually even declared to be king, but that didn't work out so well. But Solomon was kind enough to not kill him because he did that, so he gave him another chance. But then Adonijah later on asked for Abishag's hand in marriage, and Solomon said, okay, that's one step too far, because he knew when he was asking for another one of David's wives to be given to him, that it was a way of trying to bolster his claim to being the successor to David. So at that point, Solomon had him put to death. Then it begins to talk about his marriage to Pharaoh's daughter, which goes to show how prominent Israel had become at this point, because the Pharaohs didn't typically, they liked to marry foreign women to cement treaties with different peoples, but they very rarely gave any of their own women to be married by foreigners. So the fact that a daughter of Pharaoh was given to Solomon was politically a huge prestigious thing for Solomon, but it was also the beginning of the downfall of the kingdom, because he begins to amass all these foreign wives that are pagans. Particularly in the case of Pharaoh's daughter, He builds a separate wing of the palace for her because she's such a prestigious wife. He allows her to continue to worship pagan gods, and so there's pagan temples with the blessing of the king that are being set up for all these foreign wives that he has. But nevertheless, the text talks about what a wise man he was. Well, he was wise in some ways, but not so wise in other ways. But we'll talk more about Solomon's wisdom when we get into the wisdom books. But because David was a man of blood, he had fought so many wars, the Lord did not bless him to build the temple. But Solomon was able to do what David would have liked to have done. And so he builds this wonderful temple, which probably was never surpassed by even the temple of Herod, even though the temple of Herod was a pretty impressive structure. And the descriptions of the kind of wealth that it had are something that would have rivaled anything that you would have found anywhere in the world at the time and surpassed most of it. So Solomon doesn't have to fight a lot of wars. He has a great time of peace. The kingdom extends to the widest portions that it ever had before then. And because Israel is at the crossroads between Asia and Africa, if you have peace and prosperity and you control that land route, it's a great way to rake in a lot of money. So he became incredibly wealthy, wealthier than certainly any other Israelite king, and probably wealthier than most of the kings in the history of the world. But because of Solomon's mistakes, not just marrying all these foreign women, but also because he was such an ambitious builder, he asked all the tribes to basically send him certain numbers of people who worked not really as slaves, but essentially as forced workers. And this was resented by people that they had to do these kinds of things. But, back in those days, you wouldn't have been, all these projects that he built, all the things that he made would not have been possible without it. But he probably overdid it a wee bit and certainly didn't listen to the complaints of his people. So his son, after Solomon's death, Rehoboam, is faced with the people saying, look, we'll accept you as the new king, but we want some relief. We want a few things to change here, and we want you to lighten the burden of taxes, maybe lay off a little bit on how many men you expect us to go and send you to work on all these public projects. And Rehoboam, not having the wisdom of his father, listens to old men and young men. The old men say, look, do what the people are saying and you'll have a solid kingdom for the rest of your life. But the younger men are saying, show that you're not weak. Don't give in to them at all. And he said, so he listened to the younger men, and so he basically tells the people, if you think Solomon was bad, you just wait till I'm king, because I'm gonna make your burdens twice whatever Solomon made. So at this point, the 10 northern tribes say, okay, we've had it with this. What portion have we in David to your tents, O Israel, was the battle cry. And only Benjamin remained with David, because Saul was a Benjamite. David was of the tribe of Judah. So those were the two tribes that were most closely associated with the monarchy. They remained together, but the northern kingdoms, or the northern tribes, all formed the northern kingdom under Jeroboam. Now, one of the things that you'll find as you look through the rest of the account of the kings is that the northern kingdom never had a steady dynasty, whereas Judah, there was one incident in which the dynasty almost came to an end, but with that one exception, there was always a descendant of David that remained on the throne until the Babylonians finally destroyed the kingdom. Whereas in the northern kingdom, you would have a king that might have a successor or two, maybe even three, but then there would be some revolt or some underling that would kill him and everybody in his family, and he would be replaced by somebody else. But the northern kingdom, for the most part, was more prosperous. It was stronger militarily. It often had better political leaders, but they were not faithful to the God of Israel. As a matter of fact, there's not a single king of the northern kingdom that is described in this book in a positive way. Some are a little bit described a little bit better than others. Jehu probably being the one that's given the most credit by the writer of this book, but most of them are described very negatively. So you have a whole series. There's sort of, from this point on, there's a parallel history that's talked about here. They'll sort of alternate between talking about what's going on in the northern kingdom, and they'll shift back to what's going on in the southern kingdom. There's a disproportionate amount of time spent on the time period that the prophet Elijah was active, and also his successor, Elisha. So we hear an awful lot about Ahab and Jezebel as a result of that. And Ahab is considered to be the worst king of the northern kingdom. The subsequent kings of the northern kingdom are compared to him when they're bad. So they'll say he followed in the ways of his father Ahab. Prior to that, they would compare them to the first king, Jeroboam, and say he followed in the ways of Jeroboam, because Jeroboam set up these two shrines at the very beginning of the separation of the kingdom, because he didn't want his people to travel to Jerusalem to offer sacrifices, because his fear was, well, if the people are still going to Jerusalem to worship, at some point they're probably going to have their hearts turned back to the king of Judah, and they'll rebel against me and I'll lose my kingdom. So he sets up one in the southern part of his kingdom and one in the northern part of his kingdom, and he puts up these golden calves. Now you would think, well, didn't the last time we had golden calves turn out pretty bad for us? Probably when these calves were set up, it was not believed that they were actually worshiping these calves as deities unto themselves, but rather that these were sort of the thrones of God that people would offer sacrifices before. And this was something that certainly had analogies in paganism. Nevertheless, it was contrary to the law, and so the prophets that followed all had very negative things to say about this. So anyway, you have the whole stories, all the stories of Elijah and Ahab, which I don't have time to get into, and then Elisha. And with Elisha, there's a whole series of stories related to the wars with the kings of Syria. Lots of interesting little anecdotes here and there. But then finally, you have the anointing of Jehu as the next king, and Jehu basically fulfills the judgment that Elijah pronounced over Ahab, because Ahab had Naboth, who was an honest man who had a vineyard that was nearby Ahab's, and Jezebel had him killed so that they could get their land. And so when that happened, Elijah pronounced judgment and said basically that the dogs will lick your blood in the same place, and for Jezebel, the dogs are going to eat you. That was his judgment over her. And all those things happen because when you read the account of Jehu, he cleans house. He kills the prophets of Baal. He kills all of Ahab's descendants. When he goes to the palace where Jezebel was, by this time an older woman, this is, you know, well after the death of Ahab, she's looking out her window and saying, "Hey, are you here for good or evil?" And Jehu says, "Hey, any of you servants that are on our side, throw her out." And so her own servants throw her out the window. Jehu and his men go inside the house and don't immediately attend to the body of Jezebel. But then finally Jehu says, well, she is the daughter of a king, so she deserves to be buried with some respect. But by the time they go out to take any concern for her body, they find like her head and a hand, and that's about it. Everything else was eaten by the dogs. So the word of the Lord fulfilled precisely. But Jehu, because he did purge the northern kingdom of so many people associated with the previous dynasty, he also had the effect of weakening the kingdom of the northern kingdom of Israel. And so gradually, both the Syrians and the Assyrians were able to whittle down the northern kingdom smaller and smaller. God told Jehu that he would have like four generations on the throne before his dynasty would come to an end, as sort of a reward for the fact that he had done what God had asked him to do and taken care of the house of Ahab. But then you had another dynasty that took his place. I believe Jeroboam II was the first in that dynasty. And so you actually had a little bit of a resurgence in the northern kingdom for a while before it finally fell to the Assyrians, and Samaria was like a plowed field. The prophet Micah had said Samaria will be like a plowed field, and also Jerusalem. Well, it was fulfilled not at the same time, but Samaria was totally wiped out by the Assyrians, and its people were resettled elsewhere, and other pagan people were brought into the northern kingdom to take their place, which is the origin of the Samaritans. So the kingdom of Judah holds on. You have Hezekiah, who was one of the better kings of Judah, and he at first paid tribute to the Assyrians because they were so powerful, but he finally decided not to. So the Assyrians invaded the southern kingdom, and they captured many of its cities. But and we actually have Sennacherib's own account of what happened, although ISIS may have destroyed it by now. But I mean, these records are actually found in excavations in Assyria, and it says that he said that I took this city, I took that city, and I had Hezekiah locked up in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. What he doesn't say is I took Jerusalem, because he didn't. And Jerusalem was miraculously delivered by a plague that struck the Assyrian army, and then word of rebellion back in Nineveh required Sennacherib to go back to tend to his home affairs. And then he was killed in the temple of his own god by one of his sons. And so Hezekiah's faithfulness paid off. And this was during the time of the prophet Isaiah. But Hezekiah had a wicked son by the name of Manasseh. And Manasseh took the opposite approach to the Assyrians. He became a vassal to the Assyrians. He even put Assyrian gods in the temple. He, at one point, sacrificed one of his own sons to a pagan god, probably Moloch, and was the wickedest king of the southern kingdom. And we're told toward the end of the second book of Kings that even though another generation or so after him, we had Josiah, who was a reformer and was a very pious king, we're told that because of all the innocent blood that Manasseh had shed and the fact that he engaged in child sacrifice, God would not forgive. And so Josiah was killed at a very young age. And when you read it, there's the best analogy to American history would be thinking of like JFK, because JFK was this young president and there was all this hope of a new generation that he was going to do all these things. And then 2 years into his presidency, he's assassinated. Well, Josiah was killed as a fairly young king in battle with the Egyptians, because the Egyptians were traveling to go fight the Assyrians. Actually, to go fight the Babylonians, I take that back, because by this time the Assyrian kingdom was becoming weak. The Egyptians preferred to keep the Assyrians as a weak kingdom intact rather than have the Babylonians eat them up and become a threat to Egypt. And so the Pharaoh told Josiah, look, I'm just trying to pass through, leave me alone. But Josiah decided, contrary to the advice of a prophet, to go and to stop him from traveling across his country. And Josiah was killed in battle. And so for a brief period of time, Judah actually became a vassal state to Egypt, and then eventually it became a vassal to Babylon.
Jeremiah.
I believe so. Definitely, Jeremiah was involved with the kings after Josiah, because They kept rebelling against the Babylonians, and Josiah kept telling them, look, it's not going to be successful. God is not with you, because the people had not been living the kind of lives that would inspire God to want to miraculously deliver them. So Jeremiah was holding out no hope that God was going to save them, but they kept rebelling, and then finally the Babylonians destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Although the problem that you had in Jeremiah's time was there were all these false prophets that would say what the king wanted to hear, and so he would choose to listen to them rather than to listen to the words of the prophet Jeremiah. So any questions about those two books before we start talking about Chronicles? Well, there is a tradition that he's the one that wrote 1 and 2 Kings, and that's certainly possible. There's certainly a lot in common with the perspective. Critical scholars like to talk about what they call the Deuteronomist historian. And the reason why they call him the Deuteronomist historian is because during the reign of Josiah, it talks about them discovering the book of the law in the temple. And because Deuteronomy is a recapitulation of the law, a lot of German scholars decided, well, it was probably something written far later than the rest of what's in the books of Moses. And so when they find this account of Josiah discovering the book of the law, they figure, well, what happened was that somebody at that time wrote the book of Deuteronomy and said, hey, king, here's the book of the law. We just discovered it in the temple, the Shazam. And they say that because Jeremiah in particular, but all the prophets to one extent or another, echo the kinds of things that you have in Deuteronomy. So they see Deuteronomy as being sort of a book that was written in the name of Moses to advance this agenda. But the problem with that theory is, as I talked about when we talked about Deuteronomy, there's all these elements in Deuteronomy that are clearly based on a vassal treaty that did not exist at the time that they're saying it would have been written. Let me turn this off. We're almost done. Well, okay, here we go. So, I guess I'll talk very briefly about Chronicles, because there's not much more that needs to be said, except just to understand how it's different from those books. But anyway, to wrap up what I was just saying, the arguments for saying that Deuteronomy was written at this time are just really not valid. But nevertheless, when they're talking about the Deuteronomist historian, there is this sort of perspective that you find throughout 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, where they keep hearkening back to the blessings and the curses that are talked about, not just in Deuteronomy, but also earlier in the books of Moses. And so that's the reason why they give it that name. So if Jeremiah was the one that wrote it, it would make sense. But it also, these books are composed of books, and it says so very clearly throughout the narrative. If you want to find out more, are these not written in the annals of the books of Judah? Are these not written in the annals of the book of Kings? So somebody had access to records, and they put the stuff together. So what's the story with 1 and 2 Chronicles? Well, the name in the Septuagint is, if you translate it in English, it would mean supplements, because it's considered to be sort of a supplemental history to 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings. And it was definitely written a lot later. 2 Kings would have definitely had to have been written before the people returned from the exile. It ends with the last king of Judah, who's a prisoner in Babylon, being treated better by the Babylonians, being treated like a king, and sort of being restored to some sort of honor, but still in Babylon. And so the fact that it ends there would indicate that the person writing it had to have been around that time, because they didn't carry it forward any further than that. Whereas Chronicles was probably written after the people, well after the people returned back to the land, and it's sort of it definitely comes from a perspective where they're trying to see what about our history do we need to remember? So it tends to focus on more of the positive things, particularly about the southern kingdom. It talks more about the kingdom of Judah than it does about the northern kingdom. There are a lot of things that are the same. As a matter of fact, 1 and 2 Chronicles quotes from 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings, but as I mentioned, it's quoting from the Septuagint, the Hebrew version that underlies the Septuagint rather than the Masoretic text that we have now. But it adds a lot of material. Now, it's possible that some of this additional material is from other records that were brought into Babylon, and that someone just decided, hey, let's write a history where we bring some of these other elements to bear. But these books are somewhat neglected, partly because the way the book begins. It begins with talking about the genealogy from Adam to David. And then it has all these other genealogies, and there's a lot of tedious stuff, kind of like the book of Numbers, where there's all these names that are mentioned, and you're thinking, oh man, when's this ever going to end? But if you stick with it, there's actually some fascinating stuff to read. And in a lot of the details that are given in 1st and 2nd Chronicles are very interesting and important supplements to what you have. For example, you would never know that Manasseh had repented if it wasn't for what's recorded in 1st and 2nd Chronicles. And we have the prayer of Manasseh, which is a separate book of the Bible, where it's a prayer that we accept and we use in our services. But in the account of Chronicles, we're told that he was taken as a prisoner into Babylon for some period of time, and while he was there, he repented, although he'd done so much damage that it didn't reverse the course of his nation, and his son continued in his evil direction of his previous life. But nevertheless, there's at least that glimmer of hope that he would have been saved. And there's also, when they talk about David, for example, they don't talk about his sin with Bathsheba, but they talk about a lot of the happier things, because at this point they're wanting to remember what was good about this kingdom that we had before, and what can we emulate? Whereas 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings is focused on what are the lessons that we need to learn from the screw-ups of our ancestors that got us into exile. So that's the biggest difference in the perspective. Now, if we had time, we could also go straight into Ezra and Nehemiah, because there's good reason to believe that Ezra and Nehemiah might have been written by the same person. There certainly is a connection. A lot of people believe that Ezra was actually the author of 1 and 2 Chronicles, and I think there's probably a very good reason to believe that. But what you have with 1 and 2 Chronicles is somewhat similar to what you have in the Gospels, where you have these parallel accounts in the Gospels that you can compare and you can get additional insights from by comparing them side by side. The same thing is true because we have this additional account of the history of the kingdoms. And so both sets of histories are important to read, but understanding a little bit about why they're approaching things the way that they are also will help you to better understand why they're there.